Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain. I'm a psychotherapist and the author and originator of the Awareness Integration Theory. And hello to Sean, our director at the studio. This is a show about what matters most in our life, our mind, our thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. In this show, I will share the tip of the week about doing what you need to do and then moving on versus burdening yourself with too many negative stories about it in your head. Then I will share with you about how to aim for success, even if you're afraid of it, in the Ask Me segment. And I will bring you Dr. Soraya Tramayan Shirvani. She's a social anthropologist and the founding director of the Fertility Reproduction Studies Group, School of Anthropology in University of Oxford, England. We will be talking about the social and psychological aspects of infertility, third-party donors in different cultures and countries. I'd love to hear from you, so connect with me through my website, fujian.com, and follow my social media and message me with your comments and topics of interest. But first, here's the tip of the week. Dr. Fujian Zain, and this is the tip of the week. It is interesting how many stories we allow ourselves to make when we need to act on a particular behavior. At times, the behavior itself is sufficient enough, and the added stories become the hindrance. This week, I've been aware of this matter repeatedly with myself, colleagues, and clients. This happens a lot in the work environment, in marriages, or in parent-child relationships. It usually happens when someone has to do a task, which they really don't want to, at work, write a report, finish studying, write a paper, do homework, do chores at home, many other areas of life that you really don't want to do something, or you want others to do it and they're not doing it. The examples are when a person needs to do a task at work, which might take them half an hour. However, they spend hours and days thinking about why they shouldn't do the task, why their work requires it, why their life is in such a shambles that they have to do this job, why are they a failure that they have to do this, how bad the company is, how awful their boss is, how bad everybody else is, how mean and incompetent everybody else is in their life that they actually have to do this task. The point is, you still have to do the task in order not to face other unwanted consequences, but you spend many hours or days pre-task time and many more hours and days post-task creating stories about being victimized and how the world is unfair and that you just don't want to do this if it was an ideal world. Now, remember, the task only takes half an hour. The rest of the time is making up and rehashing negative narrative about it. Another example came about when a mate or a parent needed the garbage to be taken out. I'm sure all of you have felt that way. The task of taking a garbage out, 2 minutes, max 5 minutes. However, this person kept looking at the garbage and got upset all day, brew their anger, watched and waited for the other person to fail in not taking the garbage out when they wanted it. Finally, they did it themselves since it was smelly, then felt victimized for hours about why they have to do this and blasted their partner and their child for never doing anything around the house. This process happened every day. Taking the garbage out took 5 minutes. But the before and after narrative and the blast ruined her own day and her relationship. It is important to listen to your complaint and see if there are communications, agreements, or boundaries that are needed to solve a problem. However, continuing to complain repeatedly about a task that only takes minutes to complete becomes a waste of your time and emotionally toxic for yourself and people around you. It is important for you to choose to either do the task or not. Each choice obviously has some benefit and consequences. Notice if you need to communicate or negotiate for the cooperation of another person in doing the task with you or for you. If you've asked repeatedly and did not get the result, then you may need to renegotiate until you come to an agreed upon action and time which works for both of you, and it will finally be done. My suggestion is to complete the task that needs to be done so that you do not have to face the consequences of not doing the task. Listen to your own complaint. If it is about you and your life, see what you need to change or resolve so that you no longer have the complaint. If you need other people's cooperation, then join them and listen to see how two of you can come up with a solution to this matter so that it is resolved. Release yourself from unnecessary negative narratives that suck your energy and create anguish and anger for you and everyone else around you. So resolve your communication, agreement, and negotiations with people you hold responsible and accountable so that it is a setup for success and things get done versus failure and upset. For more observational skills, go to my book, Life Reset, The Awareness Integration Path to the Life You Want. Thank you. Be right back. John here in the Ask Me segment. Thank you so much for sending me question. The question of the week has been, I think I am afraid of success because I know what I got to do, but I don't. So I look at all the things that I got to plan and then I don't, and just kind of like freeze at the moment. So I can't figure out what to do because I know that this is my goal and I really want to succeed at my goal, but I don't do any action. So let's look at it together. Well, first of all, when setting a goal, the point is it has to be something that it calls you forward, that you're passionate about. Maybe the goal you set up is not something you want, but it's something that the society, your parents, your mates, your friends, or the media, or whatever makes the most money, or some other type of motivation shows up, except your passion. Maybe it just doesn't call you forward. It stops you, obviously. It doesn't call you forward. So check out. Your goal, is it for you or is it for everybody else? So it's normal that if it is for, getting validation from everybody else, maybe somehow you can also make it for you. Find something pleasurable in having that, creating that, generating it, and living into it. The other part is some people love it when they achieve it, but they really don't love the path to get to it. So let's imagine you having whatever your goal is, right? Having an amazing business or having the best mate or having, the greatest house that you wanted to have, having arrived in where you wanted to be in as your identity, as your career, as who you are. Okay. Now close your eyes. How does it feel? How is it to be in that space? How do you think differently when you already obtained whatever your goal is? How are your feelings? What do you experience in your body when you've already achieved it? So kind of like experience the experience when you have it. Now bring it with you to here and now. And imagine that every day that you do something toward that goal is that you're regenerating and recreating that emotional state and that thought process. And start behaving that way. I remember working with a lot of therapists, a lot of attorneys, a lot of physicians who were right before their board exams. And they had come so far and they were going to do that, but it took maybe 6 months, a year, maybe a couple of years while they had to kind of like stand behind this doorway before they got to be able to do that fully. And I would say anywhere you go, and when you're sitting down, when you're going outside, when you are with public, with friends, family, imagine yourself that you already have achieved that. Imagine that you are already that doctor or the lawyer or a pharmacist or whomever, whatever it is that you wanted to get to, a business person who's already achieved what they want. How do you behave? How do you talk? What do you talk about? What subjects do you talk about? So imagine yourself being there from here and now. The other part is step by step, go over what it takes to be there and then bring the goals into weekly and monthly goals. Because if you're sitting here and look at the bigger picture of all that needs to happen, you might get yourself overwhelmed and not want to go forward. So if you break these tasks and go step by step every week, every month, and even start from the future and walk yourself back and write all the steps that need to be done by when. And that way, you're kind of only doing some things until you go to the next level. And all you have to worry about is what's in front of you next week and the next month. And so not only you have the bigger vision, but you have the smaller steps to focus on so you're not as overwhelmed as you might be. So you kind of like freeze. Ask a mentor, someone who's in that process, to take your hand and walk with you to whatever fear that shows up to for you to explore and look at what it is. And you said, maybe I have fear of success and not failure. Well, most people who have a fear of success is not that they're going to succeed and it's bad. It's that they think they might succeed and not be able to withhold it, maintain it, fail after the success, or not knowing the unknown concept of being there. Well, start looking at the people who have already succeeded in the realm that you want to succeed. Look at their life and how they're maintaining it. So it's no longer unknown for you. It becomes known. And if you are afraid that your life will change, well, good, because that's the change you want. That's the change you're asking for. And so embrace it and start looking for it and start bringing aspects of that change that you think you're going to have then in your life right now. So enjoy and succeed because you deserve it.
Okay.
Hello, hello again. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I am so excited to have Dr. Soraya Termayan Shaybani, who is a social anthropologist and the founding director of the Fertility and Reproduction Studies group at School of Anthropology in University of Oxford with us. She was formerly the director of the International Gender Studies at the Department of International Development Studies at University of Oxford, and the chair of Social Analysis and Anthropology Associates, a consultancy firm that she co-founded with three other anthropologists in 1982. She's specializing in the development and aid projects. She is also the founding co-series editor of the Fertility, Reproduction, and Sexuality series. And she's carried out research in Iran, Nigeria, Romania, Malaysia, and the UK. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Of course. It has been a pleasure getting to know you and interviewing you for different media One of the reasons that I got to know you is because you've actually done a tremendous amount of research and a contributing chapter to the chapter is about whether kinship, assisted reproductive technologies and relatedness in Iran, in the book that is recently published in the Iranian Romance in the Digital Age, edited by Dr. Janet Afari and Dr. Jesslyn Faust. So it is, it's been exciting to talk to you about infertility because it's one of the most important factors that shows up in the families. And there has been such a change in the world of infertility that I'd love to talk to you about it and open it up and see what you've gained in the research in all of these different countries in the globe.
Thank you very much. As you said, that chapter is only a part of a broader study, which I have been involved in Iran for the past few decades, basically. And so the infertility side is in the context of reproduction, human reproduction, worldwide, but obviously my focus is on Iran, but we are using the studies of infertility as a lens to look through the reproductive norms and practices in a culture. Because human reproduction is a complex and intricate process, which is determined by biological, environmental, and social factors, and is the dynamics of the interaction between these factors which determines a specific culture, how basically reproduction remains at the heart of all human activities and affects every institution in society, from kinship to politics to religion to economy and other aspects of society. Therefore, by understanding what the reproductive practices and values are in each society, whether it's fertility, infertility, the two sides of the same coin, we can understand the whole culture effectively. However, the human reproduction has undergone major changes in the past 50 years, from the anxiety of planners to trying to reduce population growth. Now, the population in so many countries, the population growth is falling below the replacement level. And the anxiety is just to look at how many of these factors are due to voluntary childlessness and how many are due to involuntary childlessness. And surprisingly, I mean, the factors which are due to voluntary childlessness are numerous: the delay in age of marriage, the empowerment of women, the change of status in women. The delay in the age of marriage itself leads to miscarriages, age-related miscarriages, and a number of factors. What is really as of concern, which is this major drop of about 50% in population growth in the past 50 years, from 1964, where the population growth was 5.15 child per woman. In 2018, it had dropped to 2.1 per woman. And there are a great number of reasons for this concern about infertility. These range from, as I said, the fact that people are educated, they have reduced their number of children, but it also, male sperm count has gone down drastically. Environmental issues are a major factor for this infertility. Value of children, why people did have children before, so many, there were reasons for having so many children, to now people, you know, having fewer children. There, all of these are a number of reasons, and therefore infertility has become a major issue and very interesting. At the same time, with major innovations in assisted reproductive technologies to actually deal this problem of infertility, the whole pattern of reproduction globally is being affected and is changing. However, what is interesting is that each culture, although the technologies are the same globally, but it's in the fact how they are received by each culture that they are used differently, you know. And this is where it's not the technologies per se which are relevant to infertility treatment, but the way they are being understood and interpreted within each culture, which is why us as social anthropologists are interested in it. And of course, the most visible expression of reproduction manifests itself in kinship and how people understand kinship, why they want to have children, if there is a third party donation, how that affects actually the family structure, the relationships with same sex being able now to have children, for example. Children have two fathers and, you know, they don't know their mother in this case of gay marriages and reproduction. So these are all the issues which have really transformed the whole understanding of reproduction and the relationship, relate the whole idea of relatedness, how we understand and what are the new norms and values created surrounding reproduction.
Absolutely. I know that I, you know, within the 30 years that I've worked with families and couples and even individuals where a lot of the millennials decided that they didn't even want to get married, but they were fine with having a child. And therefore they did have a child without even the marriage. And then we saw, I've experienced many of the couples who, after a couple of years of marriage, they decided to have a child and then they couldn't, or after about a year of trying different things, they automatically went into assisted infertility clinics. I've watched a lot of the psychological aspects that happens with it. First of all, the women who are going into infertility, many of them have to take the drugs that produces the eggs. And they go through a lot of emotional ups and downs because the hormonal balance in their body changes in order to get their body ready. And it really affects their marriages. It affects their work environment. It affects their mood in such a way that sometimes those 3 to 6 months are, they become detrimental to who they are and who they behave as in their, again, marriage and work environment, and then calming down their body. But this conversation is so vast, as you said, and the psychological aspect of it are so vast also. I've recently also worked with women who, like you said, decided not to have a child. And then after a while, their biology would not allow them any longer to have a child. And then they had to go through the grief and the loss about their own body and what it means to them. And then looking at other options, such as, you know, having an adoption or the surrogate parent, the surrogate parent having a child for them. So there's so many nuances about this, but there was one thing that it was interesting to me in your research was that most of the time, and we have seen that when a woman no longer has the ability or finds out that they didn't have the ability, and therefore they go through the assisted infertility programs, hold with them a guilt and a shame, as if their body was supposed to do something and it just couldn't. So some of them, as I've experienced working with them, feel less than or feel shame or feel kind of like sorry for themselves for not being able to do that. And even in front of their in-laws or in front of, you know, people who are there, it's as if they're damaged goods and they, you know, this was supposed to be, and if they can't, then there's not obviously something wrong. But it was interesting for me in your research that I also saw that you said that the men also had a lot of shame about their sperm not having the ability of fertilizing. And that to them also hit their identity in such a way. And it really showed up also if they were going to ask a family member, like somebody they knew, to actually put up the sperm, because they wanted still, although they couldn't have the child, but they still wanted the child to have the same genetic component of who they were and their family. But then they never wanted for this to be transparent. Can you talk a little bit about your research? And not only in that chapter, but overall, have you seen this, for example, in more Eastern societies versus the Western societies? What are some of the nuances that you have come across?
Well, that is right. I mean, the case that you are referring to obviously happened in Iran, which the male infertility, generally infertility is still remains a stigma, but male infertility is a bigger stigma. And this happens in most societies where the structure of society is still basically quite traditional. And practices like, the same sex marriage and reproduction are not really accepted in those societies. Therefore, those ideas of masculinity and who you are as a person, personhood, still persists. And for example, in the example of Iran, which I've studied, what these technologies have done, they have helped reinforce the ideas of masculinity or gender relations, rather than weakening them, rather than thinking that these technologies have now come and men will understand, you know, and they will accept their infertility, and all the practitioners, the physicians do tell them that, look, there are as many infertile men as there are women. This is not acceptable. And also the fact that you, as you mentioned, they resort to their family members is A, because they don't want an intruder, a foreign body as a third party donation to intrude their lineage. And basically the purity of the lineage is a danger when you receive a gamete from an outsider. I mean, the question of IVF between a wife and husband is not a major problem. It's mainly viewed really as another medical technology. But the main issue comes when it comes to third-party donation, receiving gametes from a third party, which if we want to talk in general about Muslim countries, and of course I'll now come to other countries as well, there is a major difference between the Shia and the Sunni. And of course the Shia only form 10% of all Muslims in the world, whereas and the Shia have allowed in Lebanon, in Iran, the use of third-party donation. But the Sunni, the rest of the Muslim world, they have banned all form of third-party donation precisely because they don't want the purity of lineage be compromised. And also is seen as a form of adultery, therefore, with the intrusion of a foreigner. However, in the societies, not non-Muslim societies, in the Western countries, this is very much now accepted, where the same-sex relationship is accepted. As you said, you know, two gay men resort to a surrogate mother and they have children, and vice versa, a woman can go and have a sperm from a sperm bank and reproduce. So that is what I meant. You know, it depends. I mean, reproductive norms and values vary from culture to culture. And therefore, it's not really possible to have to generalize by saying the impact of these technologies have been the same globally, because they change. I mean, for example, there was an example of a 70-year-old woman in India some years ago who had not been able to have children, and through the IVF, she managed to conceive. And then she had a child and she wanted to go and have a second child. And then everybody told her, look, you have got high blood pressure. You're going to probably die. Your life is in danger. She said, I don't mind. I just want to reproduce another child. If I die, I've got sisters and sisters-in-law and they will look after my child. So the idea of kinship is still very much strong, that you have got to, every, the duty of every individual to reproduce and ensure the continuity of the lineage. Whereas in the Western countries, the understanding of why you want a child is not exactly the same as you find in some of these other countries. And of course, the attitude of the states themselves change as you go along towards this. But as you know, there are commissions, there are bodies when these new technologies come to force to have to approve it, and it becomes a law. And some countries have changed this. I mean, for example, Italy and Turkey are two perfect examples when third-party donation had been allowed. And then now they have banned them, so you can't have any for third-party donation. So technologies develop, but cultures also respond to it and go along and change.
Why was it banned in Italy and Turkey?
Well, Italy is a Catholic country, but also, as you know, the rate of reproduction is very low in Italy. It's almost fallen below the replacement level. And these are the decisions of the state. And in Turkey, you know, with the changes, political changes in Turkey some years ago, which is becoming more conservative society, they stopped third-party donation for the reasons that I have explained. As a result, many Turkish couples now go abroad. Even then, there are restrictions to know, to find out who are the couples who have resorted to third-party donation when they have gone abroad and come back. So there's a lot of religious reasons about it, as well as, you know, the state policy. The state policies are also very much linked also to population policies to do with reproduction, increase of population or decrease of population.
I know that working with many of the couples where they've decided that one of the parties could not have that, there's always this concept of whether they should, since they're going to have somebody else's genetics in the midst, should they go toward adoption or still have one genetic factor of one of the parents be a part of that. I've watched a lot of debates between the couples where they've had to come to this understanding. And very much the element of kinship keeps coming in there where not knowing where the other person is, what kind of genetic factor they bring in, what kind of illnesses or behavioral factor the new genetic factors brings in, it's always as part of the question that there is. Then if they do choose to have the eggs or the sperm of someone they know, whether it's a great friend or it's a relative, then there's always this concept of a attachment that they're supposing that the child will have with that adult or that the adult will have with the child, because obviously the child would not necessarily know. Some people do not say to the child, this is, you know, the reality. They're not transparent to the child for the benefit of the child. However, sometimes they always experience that the person who has biologically been connected to that child will always kind of have an emotional concept. I mean, you also see this, for example, with fathers or mothers who have, you know, gotten divorced and they've never seen their child after grown up, or even the biological mother of an adopted child or an adopted child who around 18, you know, insists that they're going to go and find their biological parent. So there's always this type of a psychological factor and a bond and a thread that is holding and that becomes part of the conversation of the couple who is who's looking into bringing a third party. That, therefore, for example, I know that in the United States, many times there's an unknown concept where it goes into infertility clinics or the sperm banks or the egg donations. They purposely create a level of not knowing who it is, a confidentiality and anonymity about it. Do you find that also in other countries, whether the Western countries or the Eastern countries, that the anonymity supports and helps this process versus, you know, in creating a hindrance in it?
Well, yes, I think it's very interesting, the point you are raising, because anonymity and confidentiality, the lines between the two seem almost blurred. You know, for example, in the UK, in the past, sperm donation was completely anonymous. So men gave the sperm. But when the Convention of the Rights of the Child in the late 1980s was passed, as a follow-up, a law was passed that it is the right of the child to know who the biological father is. So sperm donation became compulsory. So men had, not compulsory, to know, I mean, revealing the name of the donor became compulsory. As a result, the sperm donation all dropped so low, it was very, very hard to find it. On the other hand, in Denmark, for example, there are sperm banks and, you know, a lot of, I know British people who went to Denmark, for example, for a sperm donation. In the case of Iran, which I have studied more in depth, for example, there have been no laws passed, basically. There are very few laws passed to do with infertility treatment and assisted reproductive technologies, except for the law of embryo donation. All the other forms of third-party donations have been endorsed through religious edicts of their senior jurists, Islamic jurists. And because the Islamic jurists' views vary between themselves and they are equally valid, several senior jurists give different opinions and they are equally valid and they each have their own followers. One of the ways that they legitimized it was that third-party donation would be allowed, provided, but the child will belong to his biological parent and will inherit from him, because in Islam, you can only inherit from your blood relatives. And at the same time, they said the law of anonymity has got to be, not anonymity, confidentiality has got to be respected. It's very difficult, you know, if you have got to know who the mother or the father, the donor is. At the same time, anonymity and confidentiality was becoming very blurred at the clinics. It's very difficult to know. So, as I say, in each country, it varies. In some countries, they allow the identity of the donor parent should be known, and some others should not be known. However, I think the preference of the couples is not to necessarily reveal the origins of the donor parent. For example, I know in America, although they, I think I'm right in thinking that in America, it varies from state to state. I mean, each state has got its own sorts of laws to do with anonymity and confidentiality. Is that right?
I've heard that there are different laws in the different states, but they can go cross state also. Have sperm donation, and that's an ability because everything is so close. The same way as Europe, you know, the union is the geography is so close that if in one country or in one state there is a law that cannot really support the family in what they want, obviously they change and go to another state and do that. I think there's also the concept of anonymity goes away when you're actually obviously having a surrogate parent. For example, a woman who is surrogating for same sex male partners. And there's also a lot of laws and attorneys get involved from the beginning in how to do, you know, how to create that and how to get all the, rules and regulations about the liability in the future or the claim in the future. So all of those have been handled beforehand so that there is no way of coming back to it. But I've also known some same-sex male couples who have asked surrogates to be part of their life, that they actually allow that the woman, if they choose to be a part of the child's life as long as they want. So they don't feel threatened by it in a sense. And I've known other couples who chose for this not to be an issue or for them not to be. So I guess there's a lot of the need to belong and belong to a particular child, or the way that somebody says that I want to be the special parent and not you know, give away to any other ways, it becomes much more restrictive in a way somebody chooses to open the door of actually sharing this. So a lot of people might do this, but not necessarily share it with the child nor the families, because if they want to keep it confidential from the child as he or she grows up, many of them keep it confidential overall and not tell any of the family members because they don't ever want this conversation to be opened up later.
But equally, for example, as I say, I mean, when you look at this kinship and structure, it just shows you what the values are to do with reproduction. I mean, studies have been done by colleagues of mine in India, when, as you know, it's an industry in India of surrogacy, and a lot of people go to India, and the Indian women who act as surrogates are often factory workers, but they earn an awful lot more money by acting as surrogates. With the approval of their husbands, they become surrogates. And I have seen a colleague of mine had carried out this research in India when the people who wanted the surrogate mother and the surrogate Indian surrogate mother, American couple who have the child, and the surrogate mother and her husband and the child, they're all sitting together, taking a photograph saying, "We are family." So it's their concept of family is that they're all involved in this creation of this child. And there's no stigma attached to it, whether this couple later go, the American couple go back and tell the child anything or not. I don't know. I suppose it varies from person to person. But for Indians, there was no stigma. The husbands were very happy for their wives to act as surrogates. They consider themselves not actually blood relatives, which again, as you know, in Iran or in Islam generally, we have got the milk kinship. It's a form of kinship that if a woman breastfeeds, suckles a child, biologically, not only does she become related to the child, but her entire family also become relatives of that child. So there are all these sort of nuances and complicated, intricate understanding and values which determine how we practice and what we understand, what is a family and what is not. I have examples here in the UK of a young man who is gay and his friend, a woman, and they decided to have children through IVF. And he moved in and is living with the woman, although they are like, you know, living without any sex, and they're bringing up the child together. So, you know, there are so many variations in all this, and every day you find something new which has come up with these technologies developing, which really actually gives you, it's a lens which gives you, opens a window into a whole lot of other cultural practices and aspects of life, not just reproduction per se.
Yeah. And I think that becomes the most important factor and the difference about the couples who decide to adopt a child or they decide that they want to have their own, you know, genetic be there for the next generation. And this concept of kinship that you are researching about is the key factor to that. Like, I've known people who adopted children, but they also wanted definitely to have their own. So it's as if I'm duplicating myself. There's something about human beings that love to duplicate themselves. So it isn't enough just to raise other children. There's something about a part of me lasts beyond me. And I do work with women who don't have children and they decided not to have children. And this concept of the grief about not having produced a part of me that kind of like lingers in the world, it becomes a huge part of loss and grief that is ongoing, and with different types of triggers, it keeps showing up. So one is when other, you know, they go to other families and they see that they have their own children. It shows up when, you know, they think that I'm the last one with the same name, for example, that goes. If you know, some people who want to leave some of their belongings or assets to their next generation, that shows up again. I don't have anybody to do that for. And then many times as people age, and they don't feel like they're being productive for the society or earning money, or none of that matters anymore. One of the most important factors that matters is how I am for the people who I will be remaining in their memory, and everything that I have that I can give them when I'm gone. And then that brings up another level of grief and loss where they don't have anybody to do that, or where they're writing their testament and will. It's like will and testament. There's nothing to give to the next of your kin. And these become all a different aspect of you know, the grief and the loss that you could see is a part of the natural progression of every human being. And they have to face that when the next, you know, you haven't produced your next generation.
That is why you put your finger on it right at the beginning of the interview, that the feeling of failure in individuals, that I have failed, I am not a complete person. And not only emotionally, people obviously, those who want children and suffer emotionally for not having it, they don't feel part of the society. They can't take part in groups of friends, socializing. Well, they could, but they suffer. And even those who go through infertility treatment, as we know, the success rate in infertility treatment is maximum 35%. So not everybody who goes through these treatments. Some people go through 7 cycles until they reproduce, and some never do, or some actually become pregnant, some women, but they have miscarriages for a number of reasons. So there are all of these things which make them feel they cannot contribute their share to the society and also have their own child. And of course, this, as I said, in many societies, infertility still remains a huge stigma. And it has highlighted many aspects of gender relationship between men and women. And in those societies, there's a great deal of violence against women. I've written another chapter in another book called Islam and Assisted Reproductive Technologies, Sunni and Shia Perspective, co-edited with Professor Marcia Inhorn, who's the leading anthropologist among them on infertility generally, but also among the Muslim Arabs. And I have given examples of some women who had been refugees. They had sought asylum in the UK, and I was acting as an expert to courts to witness. And I'd written their stories, and with their permission, I told their stories. How they have suffered as a result of having gone through infertility treatment, subjected to men, one of them could not accept the fact that that child was not his own biological child, case of sperm donation, and rejected the child. The other one subjected his wife into horrendous violence, but to the fact that she had to run away and seek asylum. But I'm not saying that's always the case. As opposed to this, there are probably thousands of people who are very, very happy. I mean, you see photographs of this children sent to the doctors, saying thank you to the doctors. But we don't have a real insight in more traditional societies and in the cases where they are not revealing to the child or to the world that the child is not their own biological child. How these children fare. I mean, they are accepted fully, they are not. We just don't know. In this country, we have more of an insight, in the Western countries, but in the more traditional societies, it's much more difficult. But when you were referring to the biological relatedness, that how people want to say this child inherits from me biologically, in a conference, I came across a very amusing example that a colleague of ours who had done studies of the families who go, for example, to Spain for gamete donation. And they said when the child was born, he liked olives. He kept eating olives. And the grandmother said, this is because the gamete has come from Spain where they eat a lot of olives that his child is eating. So, you know, people relate the biological in a very funny ways, you know, their understanding. But equally, you find there are emotional cases. People readily give gamete to, in a clinic, people sitting next to each other. And one woman says, doctor, please give some of my eggs. I've got too many eggs. Give it to this poor woman. I've seen it in clinics. And doctor says, but this is your body. But their understanding of this is part of their body they are giving. It's not that it's out of emotion, out of charity. So it, all sorts of human emotions come to the fore. You know better yourself as a psychologist.
Yeah, I mean, I chose not to have a child and for a period of time. And then when I was entertaining the idea, then, you know, my body wasn't allowing it anymore. And I also remember, so I've gone through a lot of the psychological factors and also looking at how is it to not to have a child. You know, I've assisted in raising many of the children who are around and, you know, obviously not only through therapy, but also friends and mates and all of that. But there is a different factor when you think I chose, or again, like you said, voluntary or involuntary. And for some women is voluntary at the beginning and then their biology just doesn't allow them, even if they do. But there was also this other factor that at one point, one of my friends, very good close friend, who also went through the same concept and finally, you know, met a man who really she loved and she wanted to have a child with this man, but she no longer, based on her age, she was much older than me and could not have it. And I remember she said, by the way, I'm going to go and check my eggs. And if they're not fertile anymore, what I'm going to ask is for you to surrogate my child. And, I mean, first of all, it was an honor to be asked that, but it took me into a frenzy of emotions at that moment. And it's more like, oh, my friend is asking me to do this. But then it was like, oh, I'm going to have a child for somebody else. I'm going to, you know, kind of like get connected with this child for 9 months. And then I have to kind of like give up the child and then watch my, you know, the child who was in my body and part of my egg to be raised somewhere else. It brought such an, you know, a gamut of emotions, like from, you know, east to west of all of those. Well, you know, they finally decided they didn't want to do it. And I didn't share all of my ups and downs with them because there was no point to it. But sharing with you how much of that personally I had gone through, and you know how much of this I go through with my clients all the time, about it's, you know, it just, it is such a difficult decision for everyone as they go through this process, and such an emotional ups and downs that people go through. And there's such a beauty in, you know, when there is a child and the family's happy and the child is, you know, growing up to be a happy child and everybody's involved. And, you know, that's the best scenario. That's the idealistic scenario. And there are so much more of nuances that happens in the middle. So hopefully anyone who chooses to do that, they will seek support in, you know, calming down and figuring out and being clear in what it is that they want to do in any of the societies. In 1 minute, Dr. Termine, is there anything that we haven't spoken about your research or something that you want our audience to know about your research and your own experiences?
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here and thank you very much. But do you know, I have, as I said, I worked for over the past 30 years on various aspects of reproduction. Of course, I have a lot to say, but there is no time here. So I think we just basically encapsulated the whole thing. And as you said, sometimes women can't detach themselves, those who act as surrogate mothers. And this is the emotional side is her. I don't think anybody really fully realizes unless they go through the whole thing. And I've seen it in clinics. And what you don't need is an aggressive man to beat you up and say, but I mean, egg freezing, of course, has allowed women to, now a lot of women who have not found the ideal man. Again, I mean, my colleague Marcia Inhole has done major studies on egg freezing in America. And it just shows, you know, how women resort to it out of despair because they haven't found the right man for a variety of reasons. But it's a growing area, basically.
It has, and it comes with a lot of hope and joy at the beginning and a lot of disappointment sometimes afterward, because some of the places that they've given the egg has not necessarily kept the egg appropriately, or after they're ready, they look at all the eggs that they have produced, and not many of them are, you know, healthy enough to do. So it's been a controversial technology, which I know that a lot of my clients have. It's kind of like automatic, like women who are going above 35 and haven't found their mate. It's kind of automatic that they go through this procedure now. A lot of them choose to go through this procedure. But on the other side, when they're actually going back in order to do that at, you know, around age 40 or 45, we see there's a lot of disappointment, whether it's because of the technology that still freezes it and keeps it, or that their body, regardless, is no longer ready to be able to produce that egg. So it's a fascinating topic and an ever growing. And thanks to the medical industry for, you know, helping us move forward with it consistently. Thank you so much. I know that we are about 8 hours ahead, and you are so gracious to honor me with your presence and you know, all the 30 years of experience that you have. And thank you again for being on the show.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
For all of you who are out there, create an amazing world for yourself and everyone around you. And until next week, bye-bye.